Greetings. My name is Christian, and I might know all of you. I might not, but I have not been here, standing up here for a month at this time, and maybe even more than a month. And I want to say a few things before I begin on my sermon tonight. Let me just tell you, I was off in Princeton, and I had been invited to a school out there to teach and to be a part of a class that went on for the whole month of January. And the aim of that class was to talk about the church, and I did a good deal of speaking, and I did a lot of listening too, and learned a lot. And it was a great experience for me, and I was grateful for that time. This church made it so that I could go do that. And I went believing that there might be something that would benefit the church more broadly if I could share some of the things that I've learned here with students who will go off and do ministry elsewhere. And from the feedback of the students, I think that might have happened. And so that was my hope when I went out there, that the church, which is one, because Jesus Christ is one, would somehow benefit from some of the things that God has done here, if I could go steward those things. So to this church, I want to say thank you for giving me the freedom to do that. And to some of the students actually who are here, I'm so thankful that you're here. I get to continue worshiping with you tonight, as we did in Princeton. Now I want to say one other thing. While I was gone, Jared, Matt Agresti, Andy Newberry and Mike Oliver took on responsibilities for preaching. And you guys did a fantastic job. And I want to say two things. First, thank you for being faithful with the gifts that God has given you by choosing to lead this community in teaching and preaching while I was also led by you. Thank you. Secondly, I think that's a sign of the truth that God gives gifts to every part of his body for the sake of building the body up. Not all of you are called to stand and teach and preach, but every single one of you has a gift that God has given, and that gift was meant to be used in his service. And for me, I got to see those gifts exercised in you guys, and I was thankful for that, so thank you. And having said all that, I have to tell you, I am so glad to be back here and to be able to be preaching again. Because I'm convinced even more so after being in Princeton that the call that God has for me is to be with this community now to teach and to preach. And I have a great deal of excitement around that, and I'm so thankful for the chance to do it. So thank you for having me back. All right. Enough by way of introductions. I know some of you are saying, we have no choice. Wise thing. All right, this is what we're going to do. Easter is coming up, and you might think Easter's a far way off, and it is. It's August, or I'm sorry, not that far. It's April 12th, and if you were here at Christmas time, you might remember that leading up to Christmas, we chose to spend 1 week each on one of the characters of the Christmas story, and the reason we did that is our conviction that that story is so important that it wouldn't do it justice to just spend a week or two around Christmas time on it. And the reason we said that is that the story of Christmas is the story of the incarnation. That is the story of when God came to be with us. This is so central to our faith as Christians. And believing that, we spent almost 2 months on the stories leading up to Christmas. Now, as Easter is coming, there is a second conviction that we have as Christians, and it's this. That while the birth and the life of Jesus are absolutely central to what we believe about Christianity and our sense of the faith, apart from the death of Jesus, the life and the birth, they don't mean what they mean. If we had to sort of measure the importance of one or the other, we would have to see that the conviction of the New Testament, this is the second half of this book that we hold and read each week. The conviction of the authors there is that what made Jesus so special was not just his life, but the way it ended. And we can see that graphically. When we look at the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, we will see that the greatest deal of attention that is paid to any continuous narration of one event from start to finish is the death of Jesus. There are stories that unfold around Jesus. Usually they will depict half an hour of his life or an hour or two of his life. But when we get to the end of every gospel, we have continuous action that is described from Gethsemane all the way to Golgotha. And Gethsemane is the garden where Jesus prays, and Golgotha is the hill on which he is crucified. One New Testament scholar has said, if we want to know what the gospels are, they are preludes to the passion narratives. Passion being the story of Jesus' death. Now, the reason that these stories are so important, the stories around Jesus' death, I hope will become plain to us in these next 2 months leading up to Easter. And what we're going to do to see what we can learn from these stories is each week we're going to progress through the scenes that unfold in the Gospels, starting with Gethsemane. That's a hard one to say, Gethsemane, and going all the way to Golgotha. And so tonight, we're going to talk about the story of Jesus' prayer in Gethsemane. This is the one that Stan read for us. Now, I'm going to try something a little different tonight. I'm going to use a lot of slides, okay? I don't usually do this here. I did this a bit in Princeton, and I like the way it works, so I'll try it out. If it doesn't work, I won't do it next week. But let me give us an orientation to the story we're going to read tonight before we get into it. I think this will be helpful. We read the gospel, and what we find is a bunch of stories about the things that Jesus did, the things he taught, the people he healed. And we get to one point, and something changes, and it is that Jesus turns his face toward Jerusalem. Now, I want you to look at this. That was a picture of Jerusalem. That question mark is how I feel about this. We tried to put this into the computer, but it didn't work. But let me describe it for you, and I want you to picture this. Jerusalem was a temple with a wall around it and some buildings, and it was a city. And it was so important, this holy city, that it was mostly taken up by the temple. And toward this last bit of action of Jesus' life, he decides with his disciples to turn his face away from all of his teaching and healing and go to Jerusalem. And when he gets there, the tensions between him and the religious authorities rise. And then there's that event that we celebrate each week that you've most likely heard about, where Jesus has his last meal with the disciples. And that happens inside the city of Jerusalem. He's there with them, and he has a last meal with them. He breaks the bread with them, and he gives it to them. And he talks about what's going to happen next, and he tells them that he is going to be killed. And then at that very same meal, that night in Jerusalem, which was on the celebration of the Passover, so the city is packed, he says to them, "One of you is going to be the one who will betray me." And they become anxious. They want to know, who is it? And some of the disciples speak up and say, "I would never betray you." One of the disciples even says, "I would die before I betrayed you." And then, as you may know, they leave that meal. And what they do is they cross the Kidron Valley. Now, I want you to picture this. I'm sorry for this, but work with me here. The city is... Has anyone here been to the Holy Land? The city's on a rise, where the temple is. And then off to the east of the temple is a valley that goes down, and it's called the Kidron Valley. And if you look out to the east from Jerusalem, from where the temple is, there's this valley that dips down, and then there are some hills that rise up, and there's an actual spine of mountains that goes for 3 miles to the right there to the east of Jerusalem. And these mountains are a bit higher than the city. And in Jesus' day, they weren't populated. It was sort of like the wilderness. And what Jesus did that night, after breaking the bread with the disciples and telling them what was going to happen, is he said, "It's time for us to leave the city." And they left. And they walked down one side of the Kidron Valley, and they crossed over, and they came up the other side, and they began to rise up into the mountains, and they went to a place that was called Gethsemane, okay? I'm so sorry for this. Have you been to Gethsemane? Someone here has, and you can ask afterward what it was like, but as I recollect, it's a grove of olive trees. And those very same trees that were there when Jesus and his disciples were there, I think some of them are still alive today. They're thousands of years old. And all it was a simple mountain where there was trees and a place to be away from all of the hustle and bustle of the city and all of the hustle and bustle of the popularity that Jesus had. And so he brought his disciples that night into this dark place. Now, they had been there before because they had prayed with him before. And they got into that garden, which was filled with these ancient trees. And what happens in that scene, in that garden, is what I want to talk about with you tonight. I want to look at this scene with you tonight. And so we're going to read it together. We're going to read it in the book of Matthew. Don't open to it yet. Before we read it, I want to tell you something about this text, and then I want to tell you what we're going to do tonight. I want you to know this about this story. If you would read carefully this story, it's just 10 verses from Matthew 26, from verse 36 to 46. If you read these verses carefully, in this one scene, there is so much that would challenge you as a Christian or as a person who's not sure what to believe, that would encourage you as a Christian, that would change your thinking about things maybe that you had thought about differently, that would send you off into the world in a different way. It's a fantastic scene. I decided at the beginning of this week that I would narrow it down to one thing, and I couldn't do it because there's so much in there. And even still, I'm going to leave things out, but what I will do with you tonight is I want to focus in on three things that happen in this garden. And here's why I want to focus in on these three in particular. I want you to look at this. There are three, and there are a lot more than three, but there are three misconceptions about Christianity that I think are very popular these days that are cleared up when we take our time and look at what happens in this garden. And I'll tell you why I think it's worth clearing up misconceptions. It's very simple. There is an enormous amount of potential that is wasted because of misconceptions. There are so many fine and wonderful and gifted people who choose to turn away from God because of misunderstandings. And a lot of those people are people who come to church. There are also many gifted and wonderful Christian people who come to church week after week, and they never ever rise to the level that God has intended for them to rise in the world for His purposes because of misconceptions. And so, week after week, in many churches, and this one too, for you even and for me too, we waste away our days because of misunderstandings about essential things in life that are cleared up when we will just open our eyes and look at Scripture. Now, here are the three that I think are very, in a very clear way, addressed in this garden scene. The first is the misconceptions about depression. The second are misconceptions about prayer. And the third are misconceptions about Christian success. Now, again, there are many more misconceptions. And the ones that I'm going to talk about these three, are not the only ones that function. But here's, and by the way, this breaks all the rules of how I learned to preach when I was in school. I'm going to tell you the answers right up front. I'm supposed to, like, make it fancy and build suspense and have an aha moment, right? The Lowry loop and all this goofy stuff that you learn in seminary, but forget it. This is what I really want. I simply want all of you to leave here tonight, this is it, with a better idea about what a right view of depression and prayer and Christian success is. And not in every way, but just in three ways, all right? Here's the misconception that I think is currently very popular in relation to depression. And I put them in green, because green's like foul, all right? Three common misconceptions. I think that one of the most common misconceptions is that a real Christian can't feel depressed. And I know that in this group, there are some people who make a lot of sort of friends by always sharing their depression with everyone. And so someone say, well, in our church, the problem is people think it's too cool to be depressed. No, I don't think that's true. I think every one of us, at one time or another, either has or will suffer from the impulse to hide what we're really going through from other people in this church because we're ashamed or we think we're not supposed to be depressed. That's one misconception. The misconception that I see so prevalent in our culture about prayer is that if you pray right, you get what you want. And I'm telling you, this misconception has sold a lot of books and built up the membership at a lot of churches. But I think it's wrong. And the third misconception is this one that I want to address from this story. And it is that real Christians or good disciples never fail. This one also functions in a lot of churches to build up this sort of core group of superstar Christians that everyone else can look up to and wish they could be like. And I want to say that that's not true. And I want to say it from the story. And so here's what I want you to do. I want you now, with me, to simply look at the story in Matthew 26. Open a Bible to Matthew chapter 26 and find verse 36. And this is on page 808 in the Bibles that we have had placed on the seats. And the first, as we read in the beginning of these lines, let's keep our eyes open for anything that would help us understand maybe a different view of depression than this common misconception, which is up there now, that real Christians don't feel depressed. I want you to look at verse 36 with me. This is, again, after Jesus has crossed that valley that night with his friends and is in the garden up there on that hill. Then Jesus went with them to a place called Gethsemane. And he said to his disciples, "Sit here while I go over there and pray." He took with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee and began to be grieved and agitated. Then he said to them, I am deeply grieved, even to death. Remain here and stay awake with me. And going a little further, he threw himself on the ground and he prayed. I want to stop there. It was not unusual for Jesus to go up onto a mountain with his friends to pray. And this night, like other times, he did that. Now, it doesn't say, but I think we're right to imagine that maybe his demeanor was a little more somber than usual. He had, in fact, just told his disciples that that meal was going to be their last and that he would die soon. But as he got to the top of that mountain, he addressed all of his disciples and he told them something simple. He said, I want you to stay here and I want you to remain. I'm going to go on and pray. And then he grabbed three of them, Peter and the sons of Zebedee. These are James and John. These, if you would read through the entire book of Matthew, you would see are friends that were especially close to Jesus, maybe more so than all the others. And he grabbed these three, these closest comrades. And he said to them, I want you to come further in with me. These will stay here, but let us go further in. And he brings them in, further into the garden. And so it's just the four of them. And then Matthew says, when these four are together, that Jesus begins to become grieved and agitated. Now, unlike English, Greek as a language is extraordinarily pictorial, and it's so expressive in the words that it uses to describe situations. And the terms that are translated here, grieved and agitated, are rendered into English in different translations in various ways. And all of the different ways that they're turned into English, every one of them is the same. Every single one of them depicts a man who is entirely broken up on the inside. A man whose emotional reserves are empty and whose strength has withered away like a fig dying on the vine. And it is about to fall to pieces, this man. And Jesus, in this moment, with these four friends, does something that maybe would frighten them or would frighten me. But he begins to show them on the outside what's going on the inside. And that is that he is falling to pieces. He says, think of this. He says to these three men who have given up everything to follow him, who would consider this man their master, their teacher, their rabbi, the one they look up to, the model whom they hope to follow. He says to these three men, he says, and the way that Matthew puts it in verse 38 is, I am deeply grieved even to death. He tells them how hard it is for him in this moment. And this English, it turns a Greek phrase that is much more expressive into something that's a little more benign. Let me tell you what the Greek phrase is. The word is parapoleo, or something like that. What is it? Paralupe. Paralupos. Jeff here is a friend who knows Greek well. Paralupos is the combination of a prefix name with the word peri, which means around or circled. And lupos means grief. And the literal Greek phrase here that Jesus says to these men, listen to this, he says, grief encircled is my psyche, even to death. Now, let those words sink in for a minute. Grief encircled is my psyche. And psyche was one of the Greek words for life. My life is circled with grief. Even to thanatos, that's the Greek word for death. In the garden, with these three closest friends, Jesus unveils, he takes off all of the masks and unveils his heart to them, and he says to them, my life right now is so hard, it feels like from every direction grief is encroaching upon this heart of mine, and it's so bad, I feel that death would be better. I'm so sad I could die. Jesus said that in this moment. Has anyone here ever felt that life was so hard it was like grief closing in from all angles so that death would be better? I could ask it like this. Has anyone besides me ever felt that life was so hard that death would be a friend? I won't ask for hands to be raised because of the extraordinarily powerful lie that keeps so many of us alone in our misery, that real Christians aren't depressed. Or that it's a sign of weakness to be hurting like this. This is Jesus Christ. This is the one through whom the entire universe came into being and his heart is shattered in pieces. What does that say about this misconception. Now, let me ask you this. I want this to be personal. I want it to be entirely personal for you. Have you ever felt like that, or do you feel like that now? Or is there someone that you care deeply about who you know is in the throes of this kind of life right now? Think of that for a moment. I was sitting in a hospital room a few years ago with a girl that I'd only met two or three times. I'm going to call her Naomi. I'd never met her father until the day that I received a phone call from him. He introduced himself to me and he said, "Christian, my daughter Naomi has been going to your youth group, I think it's called Orb, for a month or two now. And we're in the intensive care unit because she tried to kill herself. And she wants you to come to the hospital." Now, I'd never really talked to her. She had been present at the high school group while I had talked about life and talked about Jesus and talked about how hard life can be and so on. So I said, "Of course I'll go." I drove over there. I came in and there her father was. I'd never met him. And there was a nurse who I think was a social worker who had been assigned to this case. And there was Naomi there on the bed. And I walked into the room. The four of us stood there. And for maybe 4 or 5 minutes, there was the most awkward small talk that you could imagine. Until this nurse grabbed my arm and said, "Would you please come outside with me, Mr. Andrews?" And I came out and I said, "You just call me Christian." She said, "Apparently Naomi has been involved in this group of yours, and I don't know what the group is or what you do, but she's been speaking so highly of her experience there over and over again, and since the time she came into this hospital, she's been asking if she could speak with you. Now, I have a feeling she wants to open up to you about something that she's not going to talk about when I and her father are in the room. So would you be willing for me to ask her father to leave and sit with her alone so that you can talk with her? Would that be okay with you?" I said, of course. "Yes, I'll do that." Now, I was a bit afraid. I didn't know what she would say. So we walked back in, we sat down, and the nurse grabbed her father and walked him out. And there I was in this room alone with this girl, Naomi. And she looked up at me, and she asked this question. She said, "Do you know why I'm here?" And I thought, there's no use for me to pretend. I do know. And so I said, "Yes. Life became so hard for you that you wanted to die, and that's why you're here." And I looked at her right in the eyes. The only reason I could do that is I myself had been in places that were so hard. And then she looked back at me, and this is what she said. This is why she asked me to come to the hospital. She looked right in my eyes and asked this question. She said, "Does God know what I feel like?" That's why she wanted her dad to leave and this nurse to leave, because she wanted to know what I thought about that. And my mind, it raced to this scene in the garden. And I practically yelled, "Yes! Yes, of course he does! There might be some who will tell you that he doesn't, that Jesus doesn't feel pain because he's superhuman or something like that. But yes, yes, God knows exactly what you feel like. And he doesn't know what you feel like from a distance. Not as if he's some omnipotent knower who up in heaven has looked closely down with some microscope into your heart and can tell from a distance what you feel like. But he knows what you feel like because his face was right down in the dirt one night in Jesus Christ as he poured his heart out with his friends first and then to the God before whom he was undone. And I could say with altogether confidence to this young person that yes, God knows what you feel like." And what a sad loss it is when Christians have to go on pretending that depression is not allowed, keeping people from the liberating fact that God knows from experience what it is to be undone on the inside. And this is why that misconception is wrong, because Jesus felt depressed. Now, he didn't stay there, but he felt it. And there are all kinds of questions we can ask about why did he feel upset? Was it the sins of the world? Or was it the misunderstanding of his disciples? Or the state of Israel that made him gloomy? Or whatever. All of those are good questions. But for tonight, we can leave those aside and just get it in our heads, all of us, that Jesus Christ himself has felt this. And so that means if any one of you here, or if I, or if someone here who's glad now, in a month or two is deeply saddened, that we should never treat each other as if we're outside because we're struggling with depression, ever. And if we would, then the one person we would certainly have to push out of our insides would be Jesus. This is the other reason why it's so important not to have this misconception. And this is why I could say this, what I said to this young woman, what I said to her in that hospital room. Because Jesus has experienced this, he can support us when we struggle with depression. And this is not just my impression, my idea. In Hebrews, and I don't want you to have to turn there, I want you to look at it, I wrote it up there. In Hebrews, there are these two beautiful passages where the author of that that book or letter or sermon or whatever it is was thinking about what it means that Jesus went through these terrible things. And he wrote these words. They're so fantastic. He, that's Jesus, he had to become like his brothers and sisters in every respect so that he might be a merciful and faithful high priest in the service of God to make a sacrifice atonement for the sins of the people. Because Jesus himself was tested by what he suffered, he is able to help those who are being tested. Look at those words there. I highlighted them for you again. He became like us in every respect so that he himself is able to help those who are being tested. That's the truth that comes from this beautiful story, that this Jesus is able to help us because he's been in that place. He goes on, the author here goes on to describe it later on in the letter of Hebrews, that we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses. When we look at Jesus as if he's some superhuman person who isn't in fact familiar with the treachery and sadness of ordinary life, we might be tempted to think that he can't relate to us because he's so high up and he can't be touched. He is so high up, but he's so high up in the depth to which he sinks. And that depth is the depth where we have one who is in every respect has been tested as we are, yet without sin. That is to say, in his depression, he doesn't let it ruin him. But he experienced it, and because he has, that, listen, this is so fantastic. Therefore, this is what we should do because of this. Let us approach the throne of grace with boldness in our sadness and grief and broken hearts. Come to the throne of grace with boldness and find grace to help in time of need. Away with the foolish misconception that Christians never feel sad or depressed. All right. I said there were three. The first was depression. We're going to put that behind us. And now, we can't put it all the way behind us because what happens in the story is that Jesus does something in his depression, and it's pray. And this is the second area that is, especially these days, rife with misconception. And I'm just going to put this one up here and talk about it before we look at what Jesus does. There is such a common misconception these days that if you pray right, you get what you want. Has anyone experienced this? I'm going to say some names. I've got a little more courage now that I've been in Princeton. There's a book written by a man named Kenneth Hagin. And I don't want to judge the man, but the book is called How to Write Your Own Ticket with God. And this is a book that has become fairly popular. In it, there is a recipe for how to become the recipient of God's material blessings, how to get the outcome in life that you want, whether it's the overcoming of an illness for you or someone that you care about, the right job, the right outcome for any event. And I'm telling you, this is fairly popular. In this book, there is the direct statement about prayer that when you pray, you should, as a Christian, you should never ask God if it is possible and then add something. And the reason he says is that all things are possible for God. And he goes on to say in this book that when you pray, if you add the words, not my will, but your will be done, at the end of the prayer, it's a sign of a lack of faith. And you should not pray that when the will of God is clear to heal. He makes these very plain, and this has become extraordinarily popular. There's another book, actually a DVD that somebody gave me, and I'm going to say the name again, and if I offend someone, I'm sorry, but I stand on the side of the Word of God and the living Lord Jesus Christ, and if I offend someone else, then I expect that he'll honor me in this one. Listen, Pat Robertson has a DVD called How to Be Blessable, and I think this is just a friendlier version of this same theme. And if someone in here has been helped by this, I'm sure there are still good things in it. But deep down, this DVD presents the idea that if you follow these procedures, you will get what you want, because God wants to bless us every time. And the difference between a person who gets what they want and the person who doesn't is that the person who gets what they want, they know how to become blessable. They've figured out how to put themselves in the place where they can receive God's blessings. And when we don't, it's because we've not put ourselves in that right place. And he says on the advertisement, you can look this up on the internet, on the webpage that sells this thing, it says, would you like to be blessable? Follow these simple rules and you will receive blessings of peace, prosperity, material abundance. It promises for you to get your finances in order if you will follow these steps. Now, in both of these cases, I believe that the success for these is so high because the human heart desires peace. We want the life that we believe is good. And we were made for a good life. We were. It's just that we almost always have the wrong idea about what a good life is. And this is the other thing. And this is way more important than that. If we look at the way Jesus prays in the garden, he breaks all the rules. And if it comes down to a book that I can buy that some guy just wrote or a DVD that he's going to sell me, on the one hand, and the simple, clear picture of how the master prayed, I have to choose the latter. And I'll tell you what, when we do that, it frees us from so much misery, the misery that comes from false hope, which is for sale all over. Look at how Jesus prayed. In verse 39, after he throws himself on the ground, and by the way, in the Middle Eastern culture, physical posture represents spiritual or emotional state. So that if you're standing up tall and straight, it means inside you're doing well. If you're throwing yourself on the ground on your face, it means you're a wreck. And so as Jesus throws himself on the ground, on his face, here's what it says. This is the second half of verse 39. Here's what he prays. My Father, and by the way, only Jesus addresses God as my Father. He teaches us to pray our Father. My Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me, yet not what I want, but what you want. Now, let me say a brief thing. If you're not familiar with that phraseology, let this cup pass. The cup was a symbol of God's judgment. And what Jesus knew in that hour is that the death that was approaching him was not just a death that was coming at the hands of the Romans or the Jews or even at the betrayal of the Christians. We'll get into all of this as we approach Easter. But was the death that came from God's wrath poured out on sin and judgment. This is an image that's all over the Old Testament. And Jesus, knowing that he was going to face this, is saying to God, please, don't make me do it. This cup of wrath that I suspect that you want me to drink, I don't want to. And don't make it happen. This is what Jesus is saying. And this should be plain. I've highlighted the first prayer. He says, my Father, if it is possible. Now, what does that teach us? Listen, this is very important. It teaches us that even the most godly person, the one who's closest to God, can still be unclear about what God's will is. That's another misconception about prayer, that if you're just good enough or godly enough, then you'll know what God's will is. What happened here? Was Jesus? He didn't know. And so he said, my Father, if it's possible, which means I'm not sure, but I want it to be, let this cup pass from me. The next thing that we learned here about prayer is that you should go to God and tell him what you really want. And what Jesus really wants here is not to have to drink this cup. And this teaches us a second thing about prayer. Listen to this. It means that you can be a godly person and your desires cannot match with God's will. Sometimes that's another thing we think, well, I'm a Christian and I'm godly and therefore I have this desire, so God must have put it there. Haven't you heard that? How many people have you seen wrecked by that idea? Almost always, it's the person who's dating someone they shouldn't be dating. Right? God put this desire in me for this person. Why would it be wrong? No, that's your hormones. That's God. People are very frequently confusing God and, you know. Excuse me. And what happens after that is they get depressed. Listen, this is the way it works. But Jesus is teaching us here that we can be a truly godly person and not know exactly what God wants. We should tell God what we want, and it might be true that the thing that we deeply desire is not what God desires. And that's why he prays the next thing, which is, nevertheless, not my will be done, but yours. This is not a cop-out. Jesus doesn't secretly think, yeah, it would be good to die on the cross. And so I'm just going to say this. No, he really does not want to go. He does not want to go there. I mean, it makes me choke to think of how desperately terrifying that must have been for him. Because this man is not frightened of anything. He's not. He doesn't have any reason to be. But he's frightened of this. It's a picture of how gruesome and terrible the consequences of human sin are. This will come to later as we get closer to the cross. But for now, look at that. Now watch this, because this is something else about prayer. He does this. Next, what happens? It's so amazing. The drama in this scene is heartbreaking. He goes away from that heart-wrenching prayer, and then he goes back to these three disciples, and they're asleep. And he wakes them, and we're going to come back to that in the last point. He goes back and he prays a second time. Now look what he prays the second time. I want you to notice the difference. That's why I put these two up there. The second time he says, "My Father, if this cannot pass, unless I drink it, your will be done." Do you see the difference in the prayer? He's not yet saying, "Okay, I want to do it." The first time he's saying, "I don't want to do it. If it's possible, don't make me do it." Now the second time he's saying, "If the only way for it to go is for me to drink it, then your will be done." What's happening is not that he's getting what he wants because he's praying right. It's that his will is being shaped slowly in his true interaction with God the Father. Not a fake interaction. Not one where he's worked up some stupid formula that's for sale about how to be blessable or whatever. But one where he's opened his depressed and agitated and grief-surrounded heart to the Father whom he trusts still. And says, I'm falling to pieces here. Don't make me do this. And now the second time he's saying, if this is what I have to do. Look what happens the third time. He goes back again to the disciples. See, the third time, now it's this. A third time saying the same words. He doesn't give up. He goes back and says it again. There's so much teaching in the New Testament about perseverance in prayer. There's very little teaching about how to get what you want by praying right. And what we see here is the one who did not want to have to drink this cup, presented that truly to God, said, "Not my will, but your will be done," got closer, came back a third time and said the same thing, until finally, this is the way the story ends, when Jesus has to return to the disciples and say, "The hour is at hand." And the hour that was at hand for him was the hour in which he would have to drink the cup. And he got there in communion with his Father on his face in the dirt. I tell you, there's so much in that for us as people who are called to pray. So much for us as we stand on the brink of going from this place to a new place where we've never met before as a church. What's going to happen? Well, I can present all of my desires to God. Maybe it won't be as good as I hope. I can be anxious about what's going to happen. Who will stop coming to Orb if we have to meet in the morning or at the Clearview Cinemas instead of this fantastic room? That's sarcastic. I can be worried about so many things and anxious about them. I can try to pretend that they don't bother me, but they do, and so I can pray. But here in the garden, we see the Lord's Prayer. Where's the Lord's Prayer? It's early in Matthew, right? This is the completion of the Lord's Prayer. The truth about prayer is that Jesus prayed right but did not get what he asked for. But that often prayer helps us let go of our desires and hold on to the will of God. Now, there's one last misconception that I want to address in this scene with you, and this one will take the least amount of time. But it's the misconception about Christian success. What do you think of when you think of a successful Christian? The green here is that good disciples don't fail. Now, you can read the story again on your own, but I want to just recount the details of this story. Jesus goes with the 12 apostles to this place. Actually, the 11 apostles, and we'll get into that later too. He tells them to wait, and he brings the three with him. Why did he choose these three? Because these three were the closest to him. These three were there when he called them to leave everything behind, and they did so without a hesitation. These three had come along the way and had had 3 solid years of teaching with Jesus. They had listened to the things he had said. When there are questions raised about the parables, when there are further discussions after his teaching in the Gospels, guess who's usually the ones talking about it? Peter and James and John. Again and again, we see these three as the ones who are closest to Jesus. Do you know that this was not the first time that these three were called away with Jesus to go up to a mountain without the rest? This is shocking. Only one other time in the Gospel of Matthew does he take these three with him. And on that time, he goes up and he's transfigured. He looks like he looks divine. His countenance is changed. He shines. They see the divinity of Christ on that mountaintop, these three, Peter, James, and John. Those three had seen him at the heights of his identity as he unveiled the true divinity, which was not changed by the fact that he was truly human. And they had seen that. And they wanted to stay there with him. They wanted to build monuments to it. They were so convinced that this was the one. These three were the superstar disciples. There was no one better than these three. And so it makes sense that he chooses them to come along. And then when he says to them what he wants them to do, just picture how easy this is. These three, he brings them. I mean, imagine yourself in this garden. He brings you there and says, all I want you to do is to hear me. My heart is falling to pieces. My heart's breaking. Wouldn't that move your heart? Wouldn't that touch you if he said that to you? And then he says, just stay here and stay awake. And he goes off the first time. And did you hear what happened? They fell asleep. And then he comes back and he wakes them up and he is hurt. This is a lesson. Jesus is hurt when we don't obey him. He is. And in simple things. Why did he want them to stay awake? Why? Because when you're depressed, you need friends nearby. Again, that's not a sign of weakness. Jesus is not weak. He's a perfect human being. And he needs friends nearby when he's depressed. And so does every one of you. If you're depressed, after I get done preaching tonight, you go into that room and pray. Would you go there, Andy, and pray with people? Go back there and say, I'm depressed and I need friends. And then tell them, stay awake with me for an hour. That's what Jesus asked. And they couldn't do it. And it happens once. It happens a second time. It happens 3 times. They fall asleep on their master. And if this teaches us anything, it's that that's a total lie. At that time, on the face of planet Earth, there were not 3 others who were better instructed or more familiar with Jesus Christ. And all 3 of them failed. And this is the truth. All disciples fail. If you have decided to start walking on the path of following Christ, you must understand that away with the misconception that you'll never fail. You will. But this is the last thing I want you to look at. And this is the other truth that is in this story. It's that Jesus never fails. And this is a personal statement that has to do with every single person here, every one of you. Because maybe it is true that you yourself have fallen asleep when Jesus asked you to stay awake. Has anyone in here ever done that? Now, this is for you. Jesus doesn't fail. You fail. Jesus doesn't. Look at what happens at the end of this story. This is the 3rd time. Look at verse 45. Then he came to the disciples and said to them, are you still sleeping and taking your rest? See, the hour is at hand, and the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Now, listen, that means that Jesus is telling them that you failed me a 3rd time, and now I'm going to die. And he doesn't say it directly, but it's true. They're partially responsible for it. We'll see that later as we see the way the rest of the story unfolds. And if you would stop and think of the times that you fell asleep on the job with Jesus, I would have to say that the scriptures teach that that act of yours is an act of betrayal against the Son of God. So that he would be perfectly righteous if he came to you as you were asleep, or to these disciples as they were asleep, and he just said to them, all right, you're still sleeping? I'm through with you. Now I'm on my way to face this deed without any help from you. If he had said that, it would have been perfectly fine. But look at the words that he says to them when he comes. Look at verse 40. He says, get up, let us be going. He still wants them to come with him. I think that is so fantastic. The Lord, who we meet, who meets us when we're asleep on the job, he wakes us and says, I still want you to come with me. He wants every one of us to come with him. Because he has something so good to do. And he wants us to be a part of that. Now, the beauty of all that he does and will do in these next hours is going to meet us week after week as we come back to this story. Next week, you can read ahead if you like. Next week, we're going to see what happens when they leave and he gets arrested. And then we're going to see some further failures of men who ought to be Christians, Christ followers, Peter and Judas. And then we're going to see what happens when the religious establishment meets face to face with this man and how they try him. And then how it proceeds from there when the Romans get involved and what light comes to us about who God is when we will sit and observe the Roman trial with this man. And then we'll even see light that comes from the darkness of the cross. And even the grave into which they put his body. And all of this will lead us to the triumphant Easter morning in which the truth of the end of this tale, which begins here in grief and agony and goes right through to Golgotha where the agony is just as deep and then comes out on the other side in a triumph that is beyond what anyone would have expected, could ever hope or imagine, and which has something to say to you and to I and to this dark and hopeless and lost and depressed world. And I would like it if all of us would come together through this and see what this Jesus has done for the world and for us who so need him. Let's pray for the Spirit's success as we continue.